the first podcast here at Central Virginia Sport Performance, www.cvasts.com. We're here today with Cal Dietz from the University of Minnesota talking about the last article he had up Monday, an insider's look at Coach Dietz's programming. Coach, thanks for taking a little time and being on here with us.
Jay, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And thanks for letting me here and write this article to post on your site and have some interaction with people. The thoughts they're bringing up are pretty good ones.
Awesome, awesome. Well, let's get right to it. Let's talk about the article here. And more importantly, this sports squat that we're talking about. Give us a little background where it came up with this idea and what the actual preference you have towards using it in the time of the year. But what does this bring us different? Because we do talk a little bit about the Olympic and the powerlifting squat here in the article. What is the benefit that we're going to see with the kids that we're working with implementing this means?
Well, my original finding on this was with Dr. Michael Yassas, and I probably should have posted that in the article, but I'm sure he'll bust my chops a little bit on that. But I know Doc has squatted like this for many, many years and had his athletes because the specificity involved of joint angles and so forth. Doc, being a biomechanist, looks at every particular joint and every particular action that's going on. That was my first findings, and came to the realization that, you know, the plyometrics that I do often takes place in this fashion. So why wouldn't I want to transfer the sport into this movement? Now, I originally thought that I can't squat like this year round, so I guess the best answer for me was to use both methods, and then eventually it came to a point where, well, then when and how do I utilize them to make them more effective for my athletes? And, you know, being the sport back squat, and I just call it the sport back squat because it works into my programming, because I'll just my other squat, obviously main one would be the back squat, but that's I would say more of a kind of a bastardized powerlifting or Olympic lifting squat in some effect. Some athletes have it a little different based upon their body type, which we'll talk about a little later maybe. But ultimately, the hopes with the sport back squat was to get the most benefits to transfer into the sport performance for that particular athlete that I can get. So basically, it essentially became a narrower stance squat. So, because my thinking was your feet are underneath you when you run and jump, and you're trying to apply force in that range of motion. And then the hopes is, so if you had a wider stance back squat, which I do a lot of the times, I found that as soon as I transferred into the narrower stance or my sport back squat, I found that the athletes were able to, again, get better results on the track, better results on the ice, because this is where usually most of the movements start, so with your feet underneath you.
Right. Well, that's awesome. And Doc actually spoken about that quite a bit with me. You know, in kind of piggybacking into what you say, let's talk about, you know, you said you used kind of a bastardized version of the Olympic and the powerlifting squat based on the athlete. Let's talk about that just real quick before we get into more of the hows and whys of implementing the other. When you look at these kids, you know, I mean, with the guys that you work with and the women you work with, you know, at the U, what do you look at to determine that, and what do you see with these different types of kids? Like, what leads them one way or the other, or what leads you one way or the other in how you have them squat?
Yeah. Well, you know, the biggest thing is body structure. I've found often that, let's say you take, for example, a Colton Iverson, who I coached, a basketball athlete, 6'11", 7 foot. And what happens with a 7 foot basketball athlete, and let's say he's got a very long thigh bone and then a short torso on a relative scale based upon ratios. the problem with that is I can't force him into a, let's say, a narrow stance front squat. More, let's say, maybe more of an Olympic style. Because his center of gravity with where his hips at when he goes to squat will be so far back, and to keep the balance with the short torso, he's going to have to lean so far forward. So realistically, that's not even an effective exercise for him, because it becomes more of a balance in squatting and a circus act than it does applying force in the form of a squat method, so that he can transfer his force into a jumping or running exercise. So, you know, if I have a short hockey player that's a 5'6", 180 pounds, but he's got short, stubby legs, he can front squat all day. But a tall 7-foot basketball player, sometimes this with a long thigh bone, so is gonna struggle. And you're trying to shove a round peg into a square hole, essentially. So you just realistically need to transfer or use the exercises, to me, most effective to get the transfer of sport into your athlete. So ultimately, I guess it just becomes you looking at the biomechanics and what's working for the kid and what's not working for a kid. And usually you can spot it right away as you look at what exercise seemed to work for the athlete and what doesn't.
Right.
And I'm sure you've seen that, Jay.
Oh, yeah. You know, the tall guys do tend to have a little bit difficulty handling a barbell, you know, on their back. But that kind of brings us down to the last paragraph of the article where you're talking about where Bondarchuk actually says that, you know, depth really doesn't matter. You know, and it's, let's talk about that a little bit where, you know, I mean, when he looked at his throwers and, you know, the guys, arguably some of the most strong, explosive athletes that we'll see, you know, around, you know, looking at joint angles and things like that, it really what it comes down to is that depth isn't as important as many of us in the field tend to make it out to be.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it. Some people, what you have is people that take it to extremes both ways, you know.
Right.
So, you know, when I start out my programming, which we'll get into, I try to have them get deeper because I want full range of motion and to work the hamstrings and so forth, obviously along with the squat, and I want those muscles to work collectively together. But as I get into a higher, let's say, sport back squat, for example, then I'm not so worried as much about the depth because, again, my hockey athletes, my throwers, when they accelerate, if you look at the first two or three steps of when they accelerate, that's the angle that their joints, when the foot slams down and hits the ground, that's the angle of acceleration. That's where they're at. And that is huge, obviously, in those first two or three steps. So, but again, you can squat deep to get more balance, but then essentially when I say balance in musculature or joint strength. But then when you
right.
go to a higher one, like I said in the article, you need to compensate with a little bit more hamstring work, possibly. It depends once you evaluate your program. But again, you're only going to the joint angles that they need to train at, maybe a little lower. And, you know, take for example, when you watch a thrower, if they do a spinning shot put, he'll make his first spin, let's say he does the first 180, and it's essentially a two-step sprint across that ring, and then he does his twisting to get loaded up to throw. But that is the exact angles in that two-step sprint that when he comes across that ring that makes him very explosive. So why would you squat him deeper than he needs to squat? Why wouldn't you become very specific at the angles that he travels across that ring at and the angle he throws from when he's wound up to release a shot at the last phase?
Yeah, and you can almost look at it, too, with the big guys. I mean, you're not going to see, at least I hope, a 6'11", 6'10", 7-foot kid that plays a 5 in basketball, you're really not going to see him squatting down like Pud Rodriguez and calling pitches, you know? So, I mean,
yeah. Well,
if you can get a kid like that to squat at a quarter squat and stay upright, I mean, the transfer is going to be there.
Well, we're getting to it's more transfer, but I think this is what everyone kind of misses, coaches. You see, watch your athletes rebound. I mean, you've talked about it before. Coach, if they don't get into that deep position when they go to a rebound, if they did, they'd never get the ball because the ball's off the rim and somebody else is reaching the ball to tie point, you know. And then you also look at you and I both know when that ball comes off the rim, a lot of these guys are still on their toes when they jump. A lot of people won't teach them to jump or do plyometrics on their toes, but I think you probably should at some point, you know, because that's exactly what happens on the field.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Without a doubt. And that's actually an awesome point, you know, because you hear a lot of people talk about how, well, you can't squat basketball players. And it's, you know, we do. And, you know, for the most part, after talking with Doc, we moved a ton of our squatting in, and it's been really high. I mean, compared to what, you know, people would say would be an Olympic or a powerlifting squat. But we do a bunch of comparable work, you know, if we want to call it the posterior chain, just so that we can sound, you know, like we're in with the fad phrase that's being tossed around. But looking at that, how do you handle that ratio there? When we look at, you said you were talking about looking at your program, and if you need to add hamstring or glute work, what are the things you look at when you implement this type of squat, where you're going to say, all right, so we're doing X sets of Y of this four back squat. We know that we need to get the hip extension work on top of that, the knee flexion work, the hamstring, the hip muscles. What are you looking at when you prescribe that specific scenario?
Well, you know, I usually add, you can do it two ways. Obviously, add an exercise, which may be the case, and I do like the glute ham, okay? And what I'll do is I've done an oscillatory glute ham at the extension phase, which would be very complicated to explain. Maybe we can I have the video up. Maybe I can send you just a post so people can take a look at it. I find that's effective. And then also I call it the glute bar lift, which a lot of people will call it, I think Brent Contreras, is that his name, Jay, correctly?
Yeah, Brent Contreras, yeah.
Contreras, yeah. He, the lift that he did with the bar across the hips, I feel that's great. So I'll either add some exercises like that and or just add some volume to the ones that are already in the program. So, yeah, go ahead.
No, that's awesome. And those... It's great to hear that because, you know, I mean, we really, both of those, you know, the glute ham, just in general, the different ways of implementing it, I mean, that could be almost like a 3-hour conversation. And then, you know, that hip thrust, or you called it the barbell glute lift, that Brett Contreras kind of, I guess you could almost say, popularized or invented almost, is really a fantastic exercise of looking. Just because of how it's displacing the pelvis through movement, you know, which is really all it comes down to.
Sure. I mean, I've seen some great transfer with that exercise for any extension sport. And then obviously, you know, it ties in, like I said, into the hamstrings and then up to through the rib cage and the core training. To me, you know, I have some 180-pound kids using 465 with that. And for reps, and you should see them. It's pretty impressive. And you talk about core development when you're doing that exercise. I mean, I think that's a huge, huge benefit for my track athletes, especially. That's where I saw the transfer. So then, you know, again, I always state that track is one of these sports that are measurable. And when you see transfer as a sport, that sport, then you know it's going to work into the other ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the glute ham can be endless amount of different combinations and tempos and exercises. So to add all this to your training, then or just your training arsenal. Okay, I mean it's very important, and the variations are big too. So then you just look at all the variations and see which one is more realistically following what happens in sports, and that's how you want to peak your particular programming model so that the most specific ones look like what's going on in the sporting field.
Awesome. Well, let's go ahead and dive into a couple of these questions. We had a couple of people post. Really, one that is kind of a common one between the two of them is how are we looking to move from an Olympic or a powerlifting squat to the sport back squat? Is it an exercise where there is, like, some form of benchmark in the other two exercises that we would want to see before we look to move to the sport back squat?
Yeah. You know, as far as strength goes, well, let me back up. So for peaking this particular movement, the sport back squat with a more narrow stance, what I found, Jay, is that a good guideline, I would say, would be between 3 and 6 weeks to get some great results with this particular type of changing into your program with this particular type of implementation. Now, but the difference between 3 and 6, let me back up here. If you have a athlete that is, let's say, weak as a kitten, okay, but you have 8 or 10 weeks to train this particular athlete, I found that I will get them strong with, let's say, your Olympic style or your powerlifting or some type of version of the squat for the first part of the program. And if they are weak, obviously, you know, if you take a look at, let's say, Zatorski's explosive strength deficit, you could actually keep measuring them. But a good rule of thumb is they need to get strong for as long as possible. So if you got them for 10 weeks, let's say the first 7 weeks, they need to get strong. Keep getting them as strong as possible, okay? So if you like the older style back squat or the different type of back squat than the sports back squat, you would go for the first 7 weeks to get them as strong as possible. And then the last three, you transfer over for 3 weeks of the sport back squat, okay? Now, you'll even find that their strengths go up because you're not going as deep, okay? So that sports back squat will be effective. Now, if your athlete is a seasoned athlete, I find that the longer you can spend at the sports back squat, let's say if you've got a 10-week training cycle, then I would go 3 to 4 weeks of training the regular back squat, then transfer your athlete for the last 6 into the sport back squat, because you'll receive the most benefits with your more advanced athlete that's already strong. So to answer the question, with that, again, the more experienced and the stronger your athlete is, the longer you can spend at your peaking with the sport back squat. Okay, so, and again, I do like between 3 and 6 weeks. 3 minimum, 6 weeks. Now, I'm contemplating this year with spending some of my athletes a majority of the season into the sports back squat. So maybe download weeks, I do the regular back squat. But again, there's all these variables. Let's say if you, for example, you want me to talk more about the peaking, Jay? Keep going.
Yeah, that's great.
All right. So for example, my track team, if I'm going to peak them, now obviously we peak for Big Tens and Nationals. We've been able to win 5 out of 6 Big Ten titles. So we feel very confident with our peaking method on these guys, and that's the coach is recruiting great athletes too, but these guys are hitting some pretty good PRs. Now, we peak in January, let's see, I think it's end of February, and then beginning of May for the Big Ten title. So what happens is in the off season, we will spend most of our time back squatting 2 to 3 days a week, and I found that if I want to implement the sports back squat, I will always do that at the beginning of the week if I'm going to do both types of squatting, okay? So, and then my deeper squat, let's say my regular back squat, will be implemented at the latter part of the week with more high-volume training in my programs, okay? So let's say that would be October through December. And then once the season comes, I will transfer all my squat days to the sports back squat. Okay. And that's for my advanced athletes. Now, my younger athletes, they will do the regular back squat just to get as strong as they can through the off season, and then in season, we will wait to the very end to transfer them into the sports back squat. So you can do it on a complete monthly basis or on a weekly basis, or you can kind of to add them together or put them together with transfer. But again, I think the biggest thing in programming is that whatever your main focus is, so if you're a track athlete and obviously you want to get more transfer into the track than you would do your sports back squat, if you want to do both types, to do it early in the week and then do a regular back squat latter part of the week. Or you could make it your max effort day two with a regular back squat.
That's all.
And then, so,
Go
what was
ahead.
that? Well,
No,
with
go ahead.
hockey, let's say with a sport like hockey that lasts longer, I will peak them. Let's say that the season ends in April, if you're lucky, and then you start over. So what I usually do is I train them with my regular back squat for the first 8 to 10 weeks of summer, and then through my training cycles, I will actually, when they really start pick up their skating in July, I switch over to a sport back squat, okay? And at that point, that peaks them for the summer, so the testing goes great. I will find a lot of great results. I think I had five different professional teams come in and ask me about my college guys just because the testing keeps going so well with them. And I truly believe that's part of the reason. Their speed levels are pretty high, and they're very always getting better in their progressions. Now, college hockey is a unique thing. These kids can go actually get tested by their professional sports teams that they've been drafted by. So my college athletes have, most of them have all been drafted by a pro sports team already. So then in summer they can actually go down there and spend time with the pro sports team. You know, it costs them money, my athletes, but ultimately they can do that for people not recognizing or understanding hockey. But so then I do my sports back squat for peaking at the end of the summer, and then I'll turn around and readdress my regular back squat with deeper back squats during the beginning of the season, and then once about November, December comes, I switch over to my sports back squats, and we spend that the rest of the year for my hockey players. So I can say 3 to 6 weeks of peaking, but ultimately sometimes it comes down to 2 or 3 months.
Right. Well, when they're playing, I mean, you know, the hockey guys are playing 3 games a week for the most part, correct?
Yes.
So it's almost like you need it for a constant peak, you know, especially with the competition and the, you know, the pressure that's on the kids in Minnesota. I mean, they are kind of the hockey team's kind of the state's pride and joy there. So.
Yeah. Yes. No question. And you know, I find that when they start skating so much, you know, they'll try to, if we're doing a regular back squat, they'll try to get higher because their legs are just beat up. And I find that also in your programming, during high volumes of sport activity, that the sport back squat doesn't beat them as up because you're not going as deep, okay? And because if they're fatigued, they're going to fight you on going for the depth.
Right. So I mean, that's almost a model that anyone utilizing any team sport can follow, is that if you're in these situations where you're playing a lot of games, you know, there's look to an exercise like this in order for your athletes to continue to improve throughout the season, to continue to get faster and more explosive and not beat them up, you know, as opposed to sitting there and trying to tell these kids to get to full depth and wearing them out and fighting these battles and maybe not doing anything other than just frying their CNS.
No, you're exactly right. And because once they get fatigued and you go, let's say you go deeper into the squat position, I mean, to come out of there is pretty aggressive, especially on their nervous system, as you said. So you'll find that, again, they're more reactive in that position because, again, it's biomechanically more sound and they're stronger already for the higher back squat. Now, one thing I was contemplating is this year. I'm not sure how it will work, but so realistically, if you look at, let's say we start out with a 6 weeks of back squat training, and then we transfer into 6 more weeks, for simplistic reasons, of sport back squat, Jay, then actually the last 3 weeks of the training model, I was actually going to do basically a sports back squat jump. Because, again, with somewhere around probably 20 to 30% of the original back squat max, we've seen many articles about how the max power is done at somewhere around 30% of your back squat with a squat jump. Okay? So I was thinking about doing a squat jump the last 3 weeks, a sport back squat jump, the last 3 weeks for peaking in my sports model. And I believe that might be something that will turn out to be very effective in my peaking for my athletes. I actually played with it a little bit this summer on some of my athletes to see where they would test it in the summer, and jumping results got greater, which, again, jumping results got greater because, again, it's more specific to what they do. Because in sport, we can have this conversation probably all day, and this will cause a lot of questions. But if you spend too much time straining with a heavy back squat load, you can actually teach your nervous system to become slower and not fire effectively. So what you do is get into the most explosive method you have, and that method would be go from a back squat to a sport back squat to a sport back squat jump. And actually, I'd probably pair that with even a lighter plyometric. So it would be the sport back squat jump, and then you'd get off that and go do a lighter, somewhat of a contrast method with another plyometric. And I think I'm going to do that with a few teams this year to see if that transfer works as well as I think it will.
Well, above and beyond all, that just makes sense.
Well, it's just, again, it all goes back to the speed of the movement. I mean, you're trying to get closer to the speed of the movement, and rarely does anything that we do in sport, in the weight room, seem to mimic the speed at which it happens out on the field or the court or the ice. So, you're mimicking, like Doc Yeses, you're mimicking the joint angles and the speed at which all these things happen. So I don't know, Jay, it may be something you want to look at or try, especially with these experiments. You try with a lot of red shirts, you know what I'm saying,
oh, yeah.
Or people. You do have to crack a few eggs to make an omelet once in a while. So, you know, the experimentation process with these types of athletes can be very, very useful. So.
Oh, without a doubt.
And then, you know, I don't know if I mentioned it in the article, one of the coaching points to that the sport back squat, Jay, was, again, I truly believe athletes need to drive their feet through the ground. And I'm not sure if that was mentioned, but you'll hear a lot of coaches in the powerlifting world say, hey, you have to drive with your hips when you're doing, you know, let's say a really wide stance back squat. And I don't disagree. That's what you need to do for powerlifting. But for sports, everything goes through the feet, the transfer of force. So one of the coaching points is that I always have to make and reiterate with my athletes is that they drive through the ground with their feet while doing the back squat, sport back squat. Okay, this is where you'll see more transfer. Then, leading into, let's say, the sport back squat jump, when you leave the ground, after you've drove through the feet and you start to leave the ground, you must drive through your big toe and push with your toes, but mainly the big one when you're leaving the air when you're propelling yourself into the air so that you transfer the forces through your feet and use the full benefits of your foot complex to apply force to the ground, and you'll find out that they'll jump higher and be more explosive, which is a whole nother article on the foot complex that we probably should post up in the next few weeks.
Oh, yeah, that would be fantastic. And that is a great point, and it's a great cueing point that, you know, I think that everybody that was at the seminar last year took home, and I know you walked through the weight rooms with us, you'll hear everybody on the staff, whether it be Coach Stewart or Coach Appel or Coach Porter, everybody, it's, you know, if it isn't pushed through your feet, it's, come on, keep your chest up. You know, I mean, that's the only other thing that you hear people yelling, and it's you can really see in how the kids are moving better just by simply having them refocus what they're doing instead of thinking of, you know, it merely is hip extension as it is them trying to move the floor away from the bar,
right,
pushing their feet to it. And it's really one of the best cues I've heard.
Well, it's so important because, you know, when they're playing sports, their brain doesn't think about moving their hips. It just moves, right? Well, when you spend so much time coaching these people up and they are not doing it the way they are in sports, I can't say for sure, but I don't truly believe there's a whole lot of transfer into what's going on. Now, the transfer of strength may take place, but the transfer of the movement and the speed isn't taking place. Okay, so you know when many times, and I'll let you in on one of the things we did here. We did a quick just simple study in the weight room. I mean, we didn't post it or publish it or anything, but we gave a group of kids, and I won't get into the details of the study, so we set it up. We found out that when we gave somebody 4 or 5 coaching points, that they produced 30% less power than if we only gave them 1 coaching point. Okay? So, again, you have to work on 1 coaching point at a time. And try not to overcoach people. I see that all the time. People are getting overcoached. But the main purpose is once your athletes perform the lift correctly, give them 1 coaching point or no coaching points if they don't need it. But the biggest thing that we always tell them is to move the bar as fast as possible when it's that time to move the bar as fast as possible. Okay? And everything else should already have taken place. And try not to feel your core if your core is tighter. Because when they start feeling all that sensory stuff, just to get awareness of their body, they're going all through this checklist, that actually takes the area of the brain where sports is played in and moves it to another area of the brain, and that's really not sports training or sports transfer of what you're hoping to get.
That's awesome.
So, and you've seen it, Coach, I know you have, where athletes overthink things, and you're not going to get the full benefits of what we're trying to do here with this sport back squat, because we're just moving your feet in and giving you a better position and making it more sport specific by position and speed and where the athletes are at to transfer into the sporting field. So, I mean, and that's the hopes of everything. So,
yeah. Well, you know, the coach isn't the only one that could be paralyzed by analysis. You know, it sounds like what you guys found is that the athletes are paralyzed just as much, you know, by you giving them too much information and they're thinking about too many things. What really ends up being what is most important for them at that time, they seem to overlook, and that is moving the bar as fast as possible.
Yeah, and I don't know what sports, but speed's not important. But every sport I coach, speed is a very important. So obviously skill and many of them are very important too. But, you know, if you're not hitting shots in basketball, but you got the speed to take it, play defense and take it to the rack, well, you know what? That can overcome some poor shooting sometimes. You know what I'm saying? So it's all about getting them to perform as well as we can, and that's the hopes. That's what we're constantly looking for here with me and my staff. So
awesome. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
I think that progression is absolutely fantastic, and you know, we've talked about that coaching cue in the past, and like I said earlier, I think it's one of the best. The other question that was asked was, and it's kind of a good lead-in after that progression is, would you use it with other squatting variations, like a front squat? Would you move their feet in closer if that was the exercise that a coach chose to use? Or do you feel that just the makeup of the front squat itself or the foot position normally would be that this wouldn't be an aspect where you'd look to implement this?
You know, I found with front squat, when you come in with a more narrow stance, then again it pushes the center of gravity farther back. And I did see my athletes, now maybe some of them with the right biomechanical structures of the body, will push as hard in the front squat position as if the bar's on their back. They seem to push much harder when the bar was on their back. Okay, does that make sense?
Oh yeah, without a doubt.
With the position of the bar in the front squat, I just didn't see it. They were more worried about holding on to the bar. So, but again, with the biomechanics of the sport back squat, you could use the front squat. You could use safety bar squat, which I think is effective. But I found the back squat, and let's say even the safety bar squat was more effective than the front bar bar placement with the sport back squat, because they're more worried about balancing than they are about applying force and pushing through the ground. And this foot placement, coach, can even be used on a leg sled. You know, if you want to do a wider stance leg sled and then eventually transfer it into a more narrower stance, I found that works for athletes that might not be able to use the spine, spinal loading with heavier weight. So, and then I believe part of the other question, as I addressed before, there was no really, with the strength part of it, there was no time that you could specifically transfer, pick when it's time to transfer. It was just based upon performance of peaking when I want my athletes to perform well, whether that's testing well for the coaches at the end of summer or performing at the end of the season for the best model for hopefully winning. And that was just about it.
Beautiful. Well, I would like to take this opportunity to throw one quick plug in. We mentioned the oscillatory method, which is something that you spoke about earlier, where people can get, you know, some more information on that through the videos on the website. And if I'm not mistaken, you also have a book coming out in the not-too-distant future where these may be some of the topics that are included.
Yeah, the oscillatory movements, as you read in the article on, I believe, on your website, you've posted it, correct?
Did you oscillatory article?
Yeah.
No, we will soon, though.
Oh, okay, very well. With that particular method, you know, essentially you're using the weakest position and doing undulations, basically, or oscillatory movements in the bottom position, but we've been able to find some huge benefits, especially with very light and loads. And again, this all comes back to the speed at which things happen in sports and using these oscillatory methods. Mel Siff has wrote about them. Doc Yeses has had conversations with me about them. And they're very effective. We use them in practically every muscle group and every almost every movement at a particular time of the year. And the biggest thing is just, again, realistically during the peaking phase and the last 3 to 6 weeks of your sports performance, because you can use lighter loads because that's the speed at which sports is played at in those lightened loads. And yes, it seems to be very effective. And I will we're putting that loading model in my book. Hopefully within the next couple months we'll have everything. It's essentially done. I just don't know how long it takes through the editing process and the publication part. So thanks for mentioning that. I appreciate it.
Hey, you got it. I'm sure that everyone will be on the lookout for that. Coach, once again, thank you very much for taking the time out your day here to talk with us a little bit. It's been fantastic. I really think that everybody's going to love it.
Well, Jay, I appreciate the kind words. And you know what? We may have to switch this. I know you're on top of things up there, and I don't hear the two-way street on this end, so I have yet to sit down with you and really pick everything apart that you're doing, because I need to know. So I think we're going to have to switch this one day, and I'm going to have to run some questions by you, because I know I've seen some things that I need to know more about on your end. I'd appreciate if we could do that versus you just kind of sucking everything up like you do, Coach.
Well, consider it done, my friend. Consider it done. And we will be in touch soon. And thank you to everybody for tuning in. And, Cal, thanks again. And we'll see you soon, man.
Thanks, Coach. Take care. Bye.
You too.